It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. You may have noticed we got a new name. Well, at least we have two words added to the name, the and John part.
You know, those are the most important words in that sentence, though, I think.
Well, I don't know.
You know,
But we just renamed the show and we're already arguing over, you know, we were talking about whether it should be John and Kirk, Kirk and John.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is what we settled on.
John with his, you know, with his tag along Kirk. You know, I mean, things, we were just debating back and forth and haven't really settled on anything, but we're going to work on it.
So, yes, the big news is that John Birdsall is now not just a regular guest, but a co-host.
Co-host, I like that.
Doesn't feel good?
I like that. I like that a lot. I'm really
very prestigious.
I'm feeling like, you know, I'm patting myself on the back here, you know. So to be
sounds like someone I'd like to know.
To be in your company, Kirk. I mean, that's an honor right there.
Well, thank you so much. I'm sure you heard earlier this week on Thursday, as a matter of fact, the DEA of our good United States of America announced that they were not going to alter or recommend an alteration, as it were, of marijuana being a Schedule I controlled substance. And the so-called happy middle ground that was proposed here is that they wanted to loosen restrictions on the ability to test the effects of marijuana by approving more facilities that can legally grow marijuana for federal studies. But, you know, interestingly enough, the findings, which I'm not sure you can really call them findings. You need to read the Federal Register notice, by the way, because it's fairly lengthy, but they do a very good job of not saying
most people read that, don't they?
Words.
Most people read
because
it's
every day,
it's fascinating reading, really is, the Federal Register.
Well, it's about, I think per day you can count on it being roughly, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 pages, depending on what is in there. But it's everything.
Unbelievable.
That could possibly. It's public notices of rule changes. It deals with mostly administrative stuff, you know, and things that are with the different federal agencies, but and mostly having to do with public comment periods, environmental impact statements, et cetera. All the minutiae of government that most people pay absolutely no attention to. So that's what the Federal Register is a euphemism for. It's the depository of stuff that no one reads. So the official government record of things that no one cares about. But when something significant like this happens, the official way of publishing a statement or finding or proposal or whatever, it goes in the Federal Register, right?
Mm-hmm.
So lots and lots of pages. I actually printed it off and killed a couple of spotted owls in the process and made, I think it was 180 pages. And I'm skimming through this, and you know, the bottom line is this. Nobody in the official government capacity is willing to say that marijuana has some quote-unquote recognized medical benefit. And that's the sticking point, because I find it odd that, you know, more than half of the states now have either – or approximately half the states now have either medical or recreational marijuana – legalized.
Mm-hmm. Four have recreational, right?
Right. And I think there's by the end of the year, there's going to be at least two more that are coming up. I know there was an election recently where it didn't happen in – where was it? Ohio, I believe it was. But regardless, the basis for a lot of different legislative bodies considering specifically the medical part of it is that there is – a lot of medical research that has from people that know what they're talking about, explaining the benefits, the unique benefits that marijuana in its various forms can offer from medical professionals. This is just so ironic to me, because if you know the history of how marijuana was made illegal to begin with.
Oh, my God. maybe we should talk about that a little bit. That's fascinating.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
And by the way, if you haven't seen it before, I highly recommend a movie called Weed, W-E-E-D, hosted by our good friend Woody Harrelson. And it's a
really?
Production. It is. It's a production made by NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and I'm on the National Legal Committee for that organization, and I had some involvement with reviewing the legal content of that movie when it was put out several years ago. But it really does go through the bizarre history of how marijuana was rendered illegal. Now, it's not surprising that that happened. It's just the manner in which it happened that was so unusual, because it happened – it was a very quick hearing, and the people that were proponents of rendering marijuana a controlled substance – and by the way, this is when they're just starting to figure out that drugs should be regulated in such a way. I mean, this goes back to when you could go to the pharmacy and, you know, buy some cocaine or heroin just because, you know, oh, I've got a cough, I need some heroin, you know? And they'd have it there, and you didn't even need a prescription for it, you know.
The good old days.
The good old days, like the 1800s, right, you know, right. Those good old days. But it was, and I forget the year, but it was like 1920-something, where there was a congressional hearing on all this, and it was the primary push to make it illegal was directly connected with a combination of the country was going through both a sort of a racist uproar at the time, still adjusting to obviously we all know that there was not the same protection of equal rights back then, and marijuana was associated with, you know, black people for quite some time.
And Mexican immigrants.
And or cowboys, I think, too. Cowboy cigarettes. Isn't that what they're talking about? When I say that? I don't know. But on top of that, there was also a resurgence of the beginnings of the fear of communism, you know, coming into our country. And, you know, there were little spikes. Every 10 years or so, you'd have this little, you know, quasi Red Scare that came along. And it was one of those laws that was motivated by trying to you know, criminalize a type of person, okay, rather than a thing.
Yeah, well, it was a method of controlling people, because right. You control their customs, and that's
so they got some goofy, you know, doctor. One person talked about what marijuana does, and it was completely wrong what the person said. You know, it renders you instantly insane. You probably are going to commit homicide.
Yep.
If you smoke a marijuana reefer, you may end up committing homicide. You become a sex fiend. All these things that, you know, were not true but were believed by many people.
Do you remember, I don't know if you saw this when you were a kid in school, but when I was in grade school, and this would be in the 1970s, early 70s, so really like right after the Controlled Substances Act that was pushed by Nixon, but...
Richard Nixon, yeah.
But
that's the beginning of the war on drugs.
We used to get treated to these movies that they would show us with a straight face. These movies where they would show somebody, it was sort of like Reefer Madness, except it was cut up into smaller little clips. Right. Like they were like 10, 15 minute long. And they people would literally take one hit of marijuana, and they would... The one I remember the best is where the kid takes a toke, and then he looks at his hot dog, and it turns into one of those little troll dolls, and then he drops it, and he screams, and he runs away, and then it's like we were all just laughing. It was like, I cannot wait to try marijuana, because this is total BS.
Yeah, those movies didn't do a very good job. Hey, you should know this, because that's actually a passion of mine. Are those old movies, the scare films, classroom scare films.
Oh, my God.
And I have a huge, huge collection of them.
Oh, you must have these then, because I think they were classics.
Yeah, I do. I have pretty much every one of those ever made. I mean, I've literally got
that
hundreds
of them.
That
is a super nerdy thing to admit in public.
Oh, it's incredibly nerdy. Some people collect stamps, you know. Other people
collect
drug autographs.
Movies. You heard it from Kurt.
movies about how bad drugs are.
Oh my God!
But there's one of my favorites is and it's true that a lot of these are focused on teenagers, and that's fine, you know, because that's the target audience that they should be directing the you know, the message towards, I suppose. But, you know, Billy is coming home from school and some shady looking character is like, "Hey, Billy, you want to try one of these cigarettes? It's not like the kind your dad
wacky
smokes."
Tobacco.
And then he's
you
like
some wacky tobacco.
Like, sure. Sure. And then he ends up like, you know, diving off of a 5-story building and killing himself or something like that. But anyway,
in reality he'd be reaching for Cheetos, but anyways.
Right. So time for a break, but we'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Hi, welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John, or is it John and Kirk?
It's Kirk and
Kirk
John.
And John, got it. It's proprietary. Yeah. And so, Kirk, you were regaling us with the story
of your
nerdy film collection, which is news to me, and now I'm dying to see one of these.
You got to come over to my house sometime. I mean, I've probably got enough of these things that would last like a solid week of binge watching. But also as part of this collection, you're going to think this is even more nerdy. I promise me, you're going to probably be agape with how nerdy this is, but I have a passion for old nuclear atomic bomb type, you know, training films and those types of, you know, here's how you save yourself from dying. You cover your head with a newspaper, you know, that kind of
thing. Okay. All right. Okay.
Just because of how ludicrous they are.
They are totally ludicrous.
The atom is our friend. In fact, some people feel a sense of rejuvenation when being exposed to an atomic blast.
Oh, my gosh.
You may notice that you don't need to wash your hands as often because it kills germs, stuff like that.
Okay,
but
all right. Okay,
I just think it's such an interesting reflection of the way, not only what our culture may or may not have been, but how people were trying to mold the culture in a particular way.
So I have two nerdy things that I've done. One is Little House on the Prairie. I was addicted to those books. Even as an adult.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you have like the DVD box set of Little.
No. The books and like not just the books that Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote, but books about them, like real, like. And I went to all the home sites and the real home sites and the museums and stuff. And then the other thing is like old Indian treaties that we broke.
I do actually. I mean, I can't say I have a passion for that, but. I had a case where I had to do a lot of research.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had to do a ton of research on a case where a treaty was part of what was going on. It had to do with whether or not they could impose the death penalty in Wisconsin in a federal case, because that's what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, the law on that is specific as to the – you know, I hate to use the word Indian, but that's the correct term, at least.
It's the legal term, anyways.
Law.
Yeah.
It's the legal term, right, yeah. Right. In Indian territories that have – where there's a treaty that governs how jurisdiction works, the federal law that relates to this is that each tribe – and it's another word that's not necessarily accurate, but each
band.
Group of Native Americans that were signers to the treaty – had to have made a decision opting in or opting out of the federal government imposing the death penalty on Indian lands. And in the absence of proof that the tribe opted in, it's presumed that they opted out. So I was dealing with a case where they wanted the death penalty and they had to go through the process of, you know, I put them to their proof and say, well, I did a lot of research and I was hunting all over the place for and treaties are incredibly complicated, not only because, you know, for the most part, they're meaningless and I say that a little bit facetiously because that's the position that the government has taken so many times. Oh, yeah, I know it said that we promised all this stuff, but, you know, we're not going to do it.
Oh, my God.
But on top of that, it ends up the way that they get created and modified and how these records are kept. I mean, it's not like our regular legislative process where things are cataloged and recorded properly. You know, it's just sort of happenstance and it varies so much. So in this case, I really had no idea if the tribe had opted in or out, but the government couldn't prove that they had opted in. So they had to back off the death penalty.
It was, nice job. It was interesting. So I'm actually just on this along these same lines. I know we're way off topic, but along these same lines, next week I'm actually going to Jerry Spence's ranch. And on my way, which is in Wyoming, by the way, the middle of nowhere, Wyoming. But on my way, I'm stopping in Deadwood, Colorado, South Dakota. And if you've ever seen the HBO series Deadwood.
I have. I have seen every minute of that series. I love it.
I was geeking out over that series because as I was watching it, I was also researching the actual historical facts. And they were actually pretty true. You know, too, I mean, there was some obvious poetic alliterations. But
for those of you in the listening audience, now you're getting an idea as to why John and I are such good friends is because we... You know, we're cut from the same cloth. That's exactly the sort of thing I do. You know, I'll pause it and then I'll go on like Wikipedia and be like,
absolutely.
Wait a minute.
So I am
when I'm reading a nonfiction book, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, I want to check that or I want to know more about that. Yeah. I'll read like, you know, a chapter and then I have a bunch of stuff I want to double check.
Yeah,
you know?
I do the same thing. I do the same thing when I'm watching some medieval battle, you know, and I'm just like, I'm gonna check this. This sounds like a bunch of baloney, you know. But anyways, last year when I went out to the ranch for 3 weeks, I stopped there for 3 days on my way out to check out Deadwood, you know, and it was fascinating. It was really fascinating. There was tons of museums. It's really a big tourist trap now. You know, they have gambling and stuff, but it's really fun, too. And so I'm going to stop out there on the way out. And while I was out there, though, I read the Fort Laramie Treaty. Now, the Fort Laramie Treaty ceded the Black Hills to the Sioux Indians, right? Mm-hmm. And forever, until George Custer happened through there on his way to dine in Little Bighorn. And he stopped through there, and he found gold. Well, when news got out in 1876, the place, people just flooded in there. Forget the treaty. The treaty was ripped up, and people just came in, and it was not part of the United States, so there was no government. There was no government. There was no police. Right. There was no army. There was no nothing. And of course, the Indians are like, excuse me, we got this treaty here. You know, it's like what we meant was forever unless there's gold. That's what we meant. I'm sorry.
Right. You didn't read the fine print that wasn't there.
It clearly says that on the footnote on page 5. So if you'll just back off, Sitting Bull.
Well, it's interesting. The history behind a lot of that, and this sounds terrible to say, but I think it's somewhat accurate to, to say that part of the philosophy that the government had in terms of whether they would abide by these treaties is that it was a whole lot easier just to eradicate them. And, instead of honoring the treaties, mm-hmm. and there were, of course, major movements to identify certain groups that were deemed hostile and to literally, I mean, not on a federal level, unless you look at Andrew Jackson's bad intentions, legitimate or otherwise, but in terms of, you know, local towns and states even that engaged in ruthless slaughter of Native Americans.
Well, they were considered simply to get rid of them. They weren't considered humans. They were considered almost really animals, in a sense. It's sort of the same way that Black people were considered at that time. You know, they were honestly. I mean, that was like the almost a biblical prescription was applied to the lens of race. So it was an easy demarcation too, because you can obviously see somebody has black skin or red skin or whatever if they're Oriental. You know, it's such an easy thing to do, and of course that just makes control that much easier. You know, and so dovetail back into what we were talking about, and that's where the controlled substances started to be used as a vehicle for control of these peoples, right? Had nothing to do with this is really bad for you or whatever, you know? I mean,
well,
we should have learned our lesson in Prohibition, but...
I mean, I think that's where the push started, but then it turned into a lot of misinformation without people bothering to actually research it because it was simply identified as an evil thing and therefore subject to it. This is the really ironic thing is that the, you know, the marijuana that was around back then was not typically very potent, you know, compared to what they make
true.
Now. And you know, do you get these as a lawyer? You may suffer the same advertising targeting that I do. But you know, the blossoming marijuana industry nationwide, I get all this stuff in the mail about conventions and product catalogs and all of it oriented towards people sort of investing in the up and coming marijuana industry.
Guess who used to run a marijuana business? President,
you?
Currently running for president of the United States.
Oh, Mr. Trump.
No, Gary Johnson.
Oh, okay.
Gary Johnson, yeah. And that libertarian bent.
Well, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes
totally
sense.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
I just guessed Trump because it would be so ridiculous, but you know, I don't know.
Well, no, he's got a lot of other ridiculous things going on, but
yeah, he's got enough ridiculous things.
Which I think actually, just as an aside, it seems to me he's literally trying to throw this election. Like he literally does not want to win. There's no way.
I've been saying that all along. It's like at some point he got tired of the idea and it would occupy too much of his time for 4 years. So now he's just going to get outrageous so that no one would possibly vote for him.
Obama is the founder of ISIS. Wow.
Yeah, that was a good one. I thought that was awfully interesting. I had to Wikipedia that one,
yeah.
And it turned out it wasn't right.
Yeah. That was a close call, but yeah.
All right. Well, we've got to take a break to listen to some people trying to sell us things. So we'll do that, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. I'm Kirk.
I'm John.
You're John. Very good.
Very good.
Interesting thing that came up earlier this week, the American Bar Association, which, by the way, I think we should comment on what exactly that is, because it's a professional organization that does not have mandatory membership. You don't have to be a member of the ABA if you're an attorney, unlike the Wisconsin Bar Association, where you do have to be a member. But the American Bar Association is, as you can imagine, a group of professionals that you know, get together with a common interest, how to, you know, basically be a good lawyer, stuff like that. And but they have these advisory rules that, like the model ABA rules. And the idea is that, you know, it's a nationwide process whereby many lawyers participate in advising and being on certain boards and things like that to recommend model rules. And they do tend to get followed or at least cited in different jurisdictions. But one thing that is interesting is that on July 21st, our Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted a number of amendments to the rules of professional conduct, some of which, you know, one in particular, emanated from an ABA recommendation to all the states to modify their professional ethics rules. And it's kind of interesting because the specific rule requires that an attorney has a duty to keep abreast of changes in the law and its practice, including the benefits and risks associated with relevant technology. Now, the risk part of it, you know, you and I were talking over the break, the risk part of it makes sense. Okay, so you need to know that if you send out an email to the wrong person and it contains confidential information, you probably haven't done everything you need to do to protect yourself. If you have confidential attorney-client-based information that you're not doing anything to protect from hacking, etc., you're probably violating a duty to protect it. But here's the funny part. They use the word benefits. So you have a duty to keep abreast of the benefits of technology. And that actually was a source of some controversy because, first of all, it's hard to tell exactly what that means.
Yeah, what? How did you define that exactly, right?
But the gist of it is you now have an ethical duty to not be a pencil and paper kind of lawyer. And you have to – and I know where this is coming from, by the way. Many courts – and the federal courts did this quite some time ago, but now we're seeing it in a lot of state courts – are going towards the paperless model.
As they should.
And as they should. And, you know, in federal court, gosh, it's been how many years now? 15 years,
yeah,
I think,
no,
that you had to
– I was very resistant to it at first, as most people were. But once I started using it, I was like, oh, this is 100%
better. That totally makes sense. Okay, wait. Let me make a side gripe here.
Okay, go ahead.
That's like a sidebar, but it's a side gripe, all right? Side gripe, Your Honor, side gripe.
Yes, approach, please.
So side gripe here. The Supreme Court – well, I'll just say the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in Wisconsin require you to file your briefs electronically. Great. Wonderful. Saving paper. Why on earth do I still have to mail my 13 copies?
I know. I just did this the other day.
Of my appellate brief, and it's utterly ridiculous.
Do you know why?
Utterly ridiculous.
I do know why. One is that there's still a bunch of curmudgeons that can't handle strictly looking at a computer screen. But
that's a cop out because you know what? The courts are the ones that are making all of us get used to the electronic age, and they're requiring us not asking us, requiring us to file electronically, which is the right thing to do because we do have this responsibility to be up to date on current technology as it's used in the course. So what about these curmudgeons? Don't they have that same duty to us?
One would think. They can always like print it off if they want to read it on paper.
Right, and then they're only wasting one copy worth of paper.
Right, I know. And what they're doing with our electronic copy is their clerks are using it to cut and paste stuff so that it's easier for them to write their opinions.
Right. But, you know, depending on what district you're in, I don't know. I haven't asked recently, but I did ask probably a couple years ago, to be honest. If you're in one of those districts where most of the judges are, you know, pretty hip, so to speak, they throw your paper copies away. I mean, you're there, and you've probably done this. I'll admit that I have. It's the day that the brief is due, and it's not going to make it if you mail it. So what do? You get in your car, and you drive to Madison. I'm afraid I've done that a few times. Not a lot, but, you know, I prefer not to.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got to meet that deadline, you're at Kinko's, and you've got your big old couple of boxes full of paper that you're filing. Drive to Madison, you know, and then walk in there. It takes two trips to carry both of your boxes up to the Court of Appeals desk. Give it to them. Give them the check for the filing fee. And they're like, thank you. And they turn around and throw it in the garbage. But you still had to do it. I've seen them do that. Well, not like actually throw it in the garbage in front of my face. No. But I've had one of the clerks there tell me, you know, it's just going in the trash. That's very nice to know. Could I have not filed it? No, you still have to. You know,
I know.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, that's a legitimate gripe as an attorney
but
who
if this just went
had to spend
yeah,
some had to spend
a
couple
July
hours 3rd. Over at FedEx Kinko's the other day. So yeah.
Yep. By the way, this takes effect January 1st, 2017. So January 2nd, 2017, I'm going to be filing a petition with whatever appellate brief I have to file to excuse the requirement of filing paper briefs.
Let me know how that
and
works.
I'm going to cite that rule stating that every one of the judges on the Court of Appeals has an obligation, an ethical obligation
to discover the benefits associated
with relevant technology.
So the other part of those ethical developments were the discussion about using emails with clients and or any device or system of devices, such as Dropbox or something, where the attorney doesn't have control over who could potentially see that communication.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a legitimate issue, I think. But it's not one easily solved, not when people are expecting and being used. They're used to instant communication, and clients want to be informed, and we need to be able to access our files quickly. And so if you use one of these, you know, cloud services, what do you do if you can't, if are we suddenly, I guess I'm asking out loud, are we suddenly barred from using them?
I think the answer is, and all of this, it has to be viewed in the under the lens of reasonableness, meaning, you know, if it's reasonable for you to conclude based upon the way a particular product, program, etc., is marketed and what you think you're getting when you get it, the fact that some surreptitious or covert person could access it without you knowing it, if that's the standard, if that's what they're saying you have to guard against is any possibility of infiltration, well, then there's no technology. It's done. We don't use it. It ends at that point. So I think a reasonable interpretation of what they're trying to do is don't, you know, it's one of these ethical duties that's really unenforceable. I mean, what, you know, there's no real way of saying you violated this rule, because what's really saying is do your best to protect confidential communication.
I guess I'm less worried
about
what
they're saying.
I guess I'm less worried about us as lawyers than I am about our clients' stuff that could get hacked potentially. That's my real concern.
Right. But you know, as we all know, if someone's going to do, the nature of hacking is such that you didn't expect it to happen.
Well,
you know, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, you still, I guess, at least for my purposes, I want to do everything I can to prevent that.
Look, this is exactly the same as when the police go around and tell, you know, they try to open people's car doors, and when they find one that's open, they knock on your door and say, hey, you know, you got to lock your door. You got to lock your car. And by the way, I found a marijuana cigarette on the seat.
I was in plain view.
But what my point is that, you know, or they had this rule in school when I was in high school. We had a principal that had this wacky idea that, you know, they'd go around and check your locker to see if it's locked. Because, you know, we had the combination things that if you left it on the last number, you could just, it didn't latch, it didn't lock. So you had to give it a spin before you left. And some people wouldn't do that. So they'd go around and check lockers. And if any of them were open, I think they were actually just trying to see what was in there. But they'd also, you know, take stuff out of your locker, and they'd have it down at the principal's office. You were kind of being punished for leaving your locker open. So in other words, if you do something where you're just being negligent, I think the ABA is saying, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court is saying, you know, you could be not protecting yourself or your client, and there could be consequences. We're not sure what. So we might, you know, we'll have to see. Well, there's going to be a test case, obviously. Something's going to happen. You know,
yeah.
It's just the way things work. So, all right, we got to take another break, but we'll be right back after these messages.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and John. And Kirk, you're going to regale us with a topic super secret.
This was breaking news.
Breaking news, wow.
Yeah, it's breaking news that came out. And this comes from out of Georgia. And there was a Georgia man, 65 years old, arrested for allegedly, I want to emphasize allegedly, having sex with a goat. And apparently Freddie Wadsworth, a gentleman, if we can call him that, who lives in Georgia, was out in his yard. His neighbors were gazing out the window when they spied this guy from Douglasville, wherever that is, having indecent relations with a white female goat.
It's the goat sex capital of the world, by the way.
they're careful here to point out that it was a female goat. Anyway, the shocked witnesses called reporting that there is a male having intercourse with a goat. And the cops didn't know what to do. I mean, this is the funny part of the story. I mean, you may think that that's – I've already said the funny part of the story. No, it gets funnier. Because the cops aren't really sure if this is against the law or what they should, you know, charge him with. And they had to, like, dig in the statutes and went, wait a minute. There is a statute that makes this sort of thing against the law. Because they were first going to do indecent exposure, which is a lesser charge. And but then they went straight for the old bestiality charge. Anyway, there is a serious side to this discussion, believe it or not. There are laws in – I didn't check every state, but I know there's one in Wisconsin. So I guess we can focus on that. It is against the law to have sexual relations with an animal.
Correct.
And you know, you might say, well, who the heck would want that to not be against the law? Yeah, I get that. But what it really, really, really comes down to, and this is just an interesting philosophical discussion, why? Why exactly? I mean, and you might say, of course, it's ridiculous. It's gross. Yeah, I get that. But people do ridiculous and gross things that aren't against the law. Like, why do we necessarily render this weird and gross thing against the law?
Well, it's...
Is it because the animals are victims?
Yes.
I mean,
my law clerk, who is a vegan and a devout animal rights activist, would be pulling her hair out right now, screaming about how you know, animals are abused in 100 different ways, and that's not even getting down to sex. I mean, we're just talking about, like, you know, cosmetic factories or, you know, factory farms or things like that.
And I get all that, but that stuff's not even legal in a lot of places. You know, you can torture an animal, you can kill an animal, like all those cows. I mean, I'm being a little facetious here. Don't think that I actually believe any of this, but it's an interesting discussion. If you line up a bunch of goats that are going to be slaughtered for their meat or whatever. And that's your farm. That's what you do, is you kill the animals. You raise them, you feed them, you kill them.
It's the whole purpose that's of not raising abuse. Them, right?
Right. That's not abuse, right? I mean, cutting their heads off, draining their blood, and stripping the meat from their bones is not abuse by definition, okay? Because they're a product. They're a thing that's being created. Now, I know it's gross. There's a gross factor here, and that maybe that's why it's against the law, but... And I understand that completely. I'm not advocating for it in any way. But isn't it interesting that if you don't cut the goat's head off, but you do something to it that any other male goat might be doing to it, you know, it's suddenly something where you're committing a felony. And I think it falls in that category of stuff that we as a society simply won't go there. You know, there's that whole category of laws that fall in that realm, you know. But I always think it's interesting to try and identify why that was necessary to make it a law. And it's, you know, remember there was a case years ago, I think it was out in Grant County, where a couple of teenagers, and this is a horrible story, by the way, so brace yourself. But a couple of teenagers were going through the obituary section, and they saw that there was a woman that seemed, in their opinion, and I think there was some substance abuse going on at the time. They ended up going to her grave site and digging up her body because her picture was
necrophilia.
Good or something like that. Yeah, and then they took her out, and then they didn't actually end up having sex with a corpse, but when the cops pulled them over, when they had like this coffin or whatever it was sticking out of the back of the car, like, what are you boys doing? Well, we were just going to go have our way with this old dead body here. And they're like, wait a minute. That must be against the law. So once again, you know, the people get hauled in and the cops are there like thumbing their way through the statute books like, wait a minute, there's got to be a law against this. Come on. So it turns out there wasn't. There's no law. There at the time, there was not a law that dealt with having intercourse with a corpse. okay? And they're like, this is just wrong. We can't charge him with this and because there's no law. What idiot forgot to put that law on the books? What irresponsible legislature left this out of our code of conduct? So, of course, you know, next legislative session that rolls around, there's a, you know, the gentleman from Grant County comes forward and says, oh, yeah, we need this law because it turns out it's not against the law to have sex with a corpse. And people were like, wait a minute. Like, we needed a law for that? I
mean, are you advocating corpse sex?
No. I'm advocating for...
Because it kind of sounds like that's where you're drifting here. And I'm just, you know, I just want to be clear for the record. I mean, it's fine.
Don't get me wrong.
It's
not where I'm going. Don't be so closed-minded. Okay. No. What I'm actually saying
is... I had a girlfriend that qualified but anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we won't go there. But anyway, in a nation that has too many laws, do you make one every time something...
Yes, is the answer.
You see something you don't like?
Yes,
is that really what you do?
You've spent enough time with legislators in Madison, as I have, to know that most legislation is not based on evidence. It's based on anecdote. And it's based on it's based on some emotional thing that happened to some particular legislator, and he gets a bee in his bonnet.
Or someone in the district.
Yeah. Gets a bee in his bonnet, proposes a bill, rallies some other people who really don't care anything about his bill, you know, and they just ram it through, and nobody really cares. That's how the mandatory minimums got in for all sex crimes, you know, because there was one legislator in South Milwaukee that wanted it. The same thing happened with criminal discovery for the defense has to turn over because of one legislator up in Green Bay. I remember this all happened while I was, you know, doing lobbying for Lockville.
Or when they got rid of discovery in refusal cases. Remember that? It was one DA's office, I think, in Fond du Lac that was all upset about
and
it.
You know what? So. And you know what? That's the power of sort of the Republican right, and they just once they've taken over. Of course, I have to say the Democrats probably did the same thing when they were in control in Madison too, or in Washington for that matter.
Yeah, I mean you can't really say it's one party or the other because they're both guilty of it, you know. But anyway, without
back to the goat sex.
Joking too much about the about the corpse thing. Okay, now again, that's something that we all say gross. Who would do that? Let's make a law against it. You know, normally you think that there's enough of the natural order of things in the world, just the way existence works, that you don't need to tell somebody, hey, by the way, as a deterrent, like you're out there and you're walking through the graveyard and you think to yourself, should I dig up one of these bodies or not? Oh, wait, it's against the law. So I guess I shouldn't. I mean, that happens 0% of the time. That's never going
to
happen.
Like the death penalty supposed to deter people. Of course, it has zero deterrence effect.
Right. It has. There's no impact whatsoever.
Yeah.
In fact, and we're going to have to hold off on this discussion until next week, but it's a brilliant, if I say so myself, segue into the issue of trial by jury.
Oh, my gosh.
Because there was an excellent article in the New York Times earlier this week talking about how it was entitled Trial by Jury, A Hallowed American Right is Vanishing, which you and I both know this is a phenomenon. But looking at what the entire design of trying cases, the reason we have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the reason we have the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and the right to confront witnesses, not as options but rights. Not as things that, you know, you may or may not wish to have part of our criminal justice system, but bedrock, foundational, you know, supposedly non-waivable rights. I mean, no one should be able to force you to do this. What they envisioned when they had these very strong requirements is that it should be hard for the government to convict anyone of anything.
Yeah. It's totally shifted around. We are going to dig deep into this one, Kirk.
Oh, we are, but it has – you just talked about whether the death penalty is a deterrent or not. No, it's not a deterrent against people committing murder, but it's a deterrent against people going to trial because it's viewed as
a tool. And prosecutors argue all the time when they work in a state that has the death penalty. They say, don't take that powerful tool away from us because it helps us negotiate settlements of cases. Nonsense. But we'll talk about that next week.
Can't
wait. So tune in. Yeah, that'll be awesome. Tune in next week, just like you can every Saturday morning, right from 8 to 9, right here on 1330 WHBL. You can podcast the show, too. Listen to it at your leisure at WHBL.com. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Have a good weekend.